Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast, recorded at CBS Interactive. I'm Tim Burrows. Back with us, friend of the podcast, Launch Management Group PR consultant Camille Alacon.
Hello.
And my co-host, Mumbrella Deputy Editor Robin Hicks.
Hello, Tim.
This week,
fair game for Fairfax and the subs chop.
Goodbye, Barbara. Is ANZ leaving Bankworld?
Brand new day, Woolies new hardware store and Virgin Blue turns to Virgin Australia.
Matchmaker, matchmaker, make me a blog.
Who wins in the head-to-head fight between MasterChef and Australia's Got Talent?
And everything you need to know about Mumbrella 360.
Well, we learned this week that Fairfax will make the drastic move to outsource most of its copy subbing to AAP's Pagemasters for its news, business and sports pages in the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age and Canberra Times. At this stage, we don't know how many jobs will be affected, although the Media Alliance suggested it could be in the hundreds. CEO Greg Highwood said redundancy payoffs would be in the $25 million ballpark, but they'd invest more in writers and reporters. So, Tim, do you think it's a depressing sign of the times?
A depressing sign of the last 15 years, I would say. I mean, it's a long time since I worked in local papers, but I can remember just how heartbreaking and depressing it was when the little local paper that I worked on, you know, we had sort of one full-time sub. And, you know, and it was great. And he knew the topic and he knew the patch and, you know, was really part of the team. Would stay late on the days he needed him to stay late and come in late on the days there wasn't any copy to sub. And, of course, because it was a weekly paper, that was a thing. There were quiet days and busy days for him. So the powers that be that decided, actually, much more efficient, put, you know, all of the papers from the neighbouring counties together in one big subbing factory, drag most of those subs over there, and then they don't have quiet days because they're busy every day because there's always a paper going to press. So that was what they did. And of course, what you lose is you lose your local connection, you lose, you know, the sub doesn't feel attached to that particular project, that particular product. So it doesn't want to, you know, go the extra mile to kind of do a good job. They don't really understand the tone of the title. So for us, we were really trashing down market and the rest was quite broadsheet. So, of course, it just meant that the headlines became very bland as well.
Yeah, but don't you lose part of the newspaper culture? I mean, a couple of magazines ago for me at Campaign in London, the magazine that was pretty much run by the subs, I mean, it was called sort of Dictionary Corner, affectionately, but they really did rule the roost. I mean, if you were late on copy, they'd stand behind you, arms folded, and wait until you'd finished a story. And they really did run the show. And I think to remove that, you lose part of the culture.
Yeah, they kind of made the train, you know, that was one of the things they did. They would make the trains run on time. You know, I mean, going way, way back in newspapers, when I sort of very first trained in, God, 1989, we were still on typewriters where you would type two paragraphs of copy on a folio. And literally, as you were typing it, if you were on deadline, your folio would be taken away and the subs would be processing it while you were writing the next two paragraphs of your story. But, you know, they were the people who stopped you from looking like idiots because they'd been there for 20 years. They knew far more than you did about the subject matter.
That's so true. It's they can make you look like gold. And also, someone needs to crack the whip and, you know, that's what they're there for as well. But in terms of my experience, I know when I was first starting out, I was working with a really good sub, and it was a 300-word little news piece. And I thought, okay, yeah, did a decent enough job. I read it the next day in the magazine, and he'd totally rewritten it. And I thought, sat back, and I thought, wow, that sounds really good. I sound so intelligent. But I think the key is that it made me stop and think about the structure, the tone, and the style, and really think about how I'm writing a story. Because it's one thing getting the story; it's another thing writing it in a way that would best communicate why it's important, why I need to read it to the reader.
I suppose the one thing in Fairfax's defence is if I was running Fairfax, looking at the latest new drop in revenue that they're looking at over the last year, you know, they can't go on as they are. They've got to do something. And although this is a pretty bad thing, maybe it's the least bad thing. You know, I couldn't say this is the clever business plan I would have instead.
So it's sort of okay to, I mean, are they commoditizing subbing? And centralising.
Oh, totally. Yeah. So the idea is it's all outsourced to PageMasters, who, and unfortunately I apologise to Alice because we're going to have to put an advisory on this one now, but I noticed that one sub leaving The Age recently referred to them in his leaving speech as page fuckers. So I think different people have got different views on the quality of the output. But I think most people think they do a pretty solid job. But, yes, yeah, it's commoditized. It's people very efficiently churning through a lot of pages, you know, very, very fast.
And do you think perhaps there's potential it could damage the papers in terms of, yeah, as you mentioned, the local connection? Do you think the quality of the journalism could suffer?
Yeah, in a number of ways. Firstly, reputationally, you know, the fact that this has been going on is out there, everybody knows. I know that they're also saying, and it will be accompanied by them investing in some new reporters. So this idea that they put the emphasis on the reporting and outsource the production bit. But stuff will slip through, you know.
Interesting. I know two of the key things that Greg said was, you know, they'll be recruiting a number of high-quality reporters and writers and expanding their traineeship program. Ironically enough, for me, you know, I would say the greener the reporter, the more they would gain out of a really good sub. But also, let's not forget in 2008, they Fairfax, Australia, New Zealand, cut about 5% of its full-time staff. One-third of that was editorial staff. So what the key component from his memo to his staff was more about the multimedia training and the equipment. Obviously, part of the future-proofing. If you believe in 15, 20 years' time, the new newspaper will be on a tablet or Minority Report style, then obviously the investment into equipment and that kind of training towards technology and how to use it and how to utilize it is part of the future-proofing of a media company such as a Fairfax.
Yeah, I mean, and I suppose that's the thing is, I mean, honestly, this is a conversation we've been having for, you know, the last 2 years at least. There, you know, there isn't an obvious solution. Nobody actually knows where newspapers are going to go. You know, maybe tablets will be a small part of it. We'll talk a bit later in today's podcast, but, you know, at some point we'll hear more about what News Limited intends in terms of paywalls. And we've got Richard Freudenstein from News talking at Umbrella 360, and I'm sure that'll be one of the topics that that he talks about.
Next, Goodbye Barbara, is ANZ sacking the bank manager?
Get in.
Wouldn't we be more comfortable inside the house?
You're so comfortable in there, why do you want to move?
OK, we're interested in some flexible home loan options.
Options? How many homes are you buying, Superman?
Just one.
Then it'll be option one.
We just don't want to get stuck with the wrong loan if things change.
Oh, you'll have 25-odd years to get used to it.
How about a loan that's half fixed, half variable?
In case we have more kids.
More? Of them?
Barbara lives in Bankworld.
Hi, I'm from ANZ.
But we live in your world and bring you flexible home loans as Home Lender of the Year.
You might recall Barbara, who, as you heard there, according to ANZ, lives in Bankworld. Now, on those TV ads, she was that unhelpful, rude woman who customers encountered in ANZ's opposition banks. But ANZ has now reverted to ads which last ran a couple of years back, commending itself on being Home Lender of the Year. And Barbara's not aired since March. Now, that's also coincided with a change of agencies as well. M&T Saatchi were the creators of Barbara and are no longer the agency behind her. Personally, Robin, I found her very amusing, but I'm not sure it made me think, ANZ are different to everyone else. It was just a reminder to me that banks can be a bit of a harrowing experience.
Yeah, no, I liked the character. I've looked back at a few of the clips from past commercials, about three or four in the series. I actually warmed her. I think she's sort of personable and addressed a situation that is commonplace banking Australia. But yeah, to get rid of her now, I think the timing's obviously interesting. The ad that ran over the weekend was created by M&C Saatchi, as you said, years ago, adapted by DDB Melbourne.
Who are the new agency?
Yeah.
So we haven't seen the first of their new work.
No. DDB obviously was the old incumbent. Wybins is the new agency.
Oh, of course. Sorry, no, I stand corrected. Yes, no, because it was both M&C and DDB have both worked on ANZ previously.
Yeah, that's
right. And it was a three-way pitch, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. And which Wybins won? I think there's a sense that perhaps they're clearing the decks. They want to get rid of perhaps past baggage and move on to a new agency, wipe the slate clean.
It's very rare for a campaign idea or for a strapline to survive a new agency, isn't it?
Yeah, no, indeed. And I think, it'd be interesting to see what's next and Wyben wants to, I don't know, as I said, a fresh start.
Camille, how do you feel about Barbara?
Well, if Barbara was so good and successful, they would have maintained it, regardless. Again, as you guys, as most people think, the ads were quite funny. It was like watching a skit, almost a branded entertainment skit for me, to be honest with you, except for the fact that, unfortunately, the image ANZ was trying to portray didn't ring true with the consumers, because it pretty much, as the parody of the campaign from Get Up said, is just another bloody bank. So I suspect that that's probably why, in the end, it didn't really work.
Well, of course, the branded entertainment, she was one of the few funny things about the Ben Elton show then, wasn't she? When she
I didn't watch the Ben Elton show. Yeah, were you one of the 10 people who watched
it? Well, I felt duty banned too at times, but one of the things was the actress who I want to say is called Denise Flood, but I might be making that up completely. One of the things she did was sort of, you know, interviews with sort of B and C list celebs, in a persona not that much different to a Barbara the bank manager, and that actually worked really well as a segment, but one of the few that did. What's your favourite bank advertising?
Nothing of late. I'm really not a fan of any of the Combank ads at all. I think the Bank West ads are cute, but I'm not really sure why. it's just a bit different and odd, and I think that's, you know, part of their positioning of not being one of the big ones, so that kind of works for them.
That's by Host, I think, is it?
Your guess is as good as mine.
I think it is, with the talking animals.
Talking animals and now stuffed things.
Yes, I think that's
stuffed animals.
It'd be interesting to see on the Wyben's thing whether the visit of Greenpeace will have any impact on, well, not, obviously not on their general mainstream advertising campaigns, but on their green messaging.
Yes, for people who missed this, after Wyben's was appointed, some of the good folk at Greenpeace turned up outside the office with some leaflets for them.
On bicycles.
Yes.
But yeah, I'd be interested to see, well, whether they obviously they like to beat the drum about their green messaging. Will they continue to do so after the visit of Greenpeace?
Well, next, brand new day, Woolies new hardware store, and Virgin Blue turns into Virgin Australia.
With more than 94.5 million active users globally, eBay is the world's largest online marketplace. Visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
Brand creator Hans Holzbusch has been busy over the last week with the launch and relaunch of two new brands. The first was Masters, Woolworth's new hardware retail brand, which had a few Mumbrella commentators viciously tapping the keys about its logo. It's meant to represent a power tool drill bit. So Camille, what did you think of it?
Did he actually say that, drill bit, or did you...
And I interviewed him, and I was sort of... I couldn't work out what the logo actually was. It looked to me like a sort of three shark's fins sort of cutting through the water.
Really?
Or, yeah, other people said, well, it looks like the Opera House with the three sort of curved bits to it. But, yeah, no, Hans pointed out after a bit of questioning that it was...
The drill bit.
Yeah.
The bit of the drill, the component of the bit of the drill.
He does like to find double meanings, doesn't he? It's rather like, I think he was also behind the new look Woolworths one.
Yes.
Which, of course, has a hint of an apple about it as well as the sort of W, you know. So.
Right.
Look, I actually like one. I like the name. For me, it implies expertise, authority, masters, you know, and it's a type of name you can trust, and you want to trust something if you're building things. And for me, actually, the logo looks more like a lion's paw.
Right.
So lion's paw, masters, you know, master of the jungle. I'm thinking more of a gold and yellow color instead of blue. Just trying to change it all together in my mind. But that would be my interpretation. But I like the name Masters, which separates it quite a lot from Bunnings, Mitre 10, which seems a bit below that.
Yeah, that's the issue, isn't it, Tim? So what do you think? This is enough to create impression on the market?
The thing is, it's one part of a much bigger puzzle, isn't it? You know, it's not literally just about the logo. It's how you use it. It's the colours. But it's also the, you know, brand tone and all of those slightly wanky sounding things, which are actually important. It will be the advertising that goes alongside it, you know. So I guess the job of a logo really is, you know, to give a platform that you can build on. And so long as you don't make someone look like a laughing stock, then you've probably done half of the job. I think it's fine.
Yeah, and Woolworths has a great opportunity to build on the market and take on Bunnings, you think?
Yeah, I mean, giant duopolies generally do quite well in Australia, don't they? So it'll be hard to think they'll do any different in this segment.
They're trying to attract more of the professionals, aren't they? That sector of the... Hence, I suppose, the name Masters as well.
Well, I suppose, yeah, because Bunnings does feel a bit...
DIY.
But there again, I don't know enough about the segment. My first impression would be you can't really rely on the wholesale side of things to be your main point of trade. You kind of can't alienate the public. Just really give the feel that hey, we're the one that the tradies come to. If you want to buy just a couple of screws, then we're not interested in you. So it's again, I guess positioning will be a balance to be made. Mm.
Still with Holzbosch rebrands, we also had the relaunch of Virgin Blue to Virgin Australia this week. So the move will see all of Virgin's Australian planes, V Australia, Virgin Blue, Pacific Blue and Polynesian Blue, brought under the name in a bid to take on Qantas in the business market. So podcast producer Alice Terlikovsky talked to Virgin boss Richard Branson about it.
Generally speaking, I think we like to think that we get it right at the beginning and therefore we don't have to rebrand it. With Virgin Blue, I don't think we got it wrong, but I just think times have moved on, and there was just this sort of realization that why let Qantas, keep all that money, put all that business class money? Why not, grab it off them, and make sure that we can use it to benefit our economy class passengers and be more competitive. And it would have been better, I suspect, if we'd done it 10 years ago. But anyway, we finally realised.
So, Alice, you talked to Sir Richard. Thoughts on the rebrand?
Yeah, I did. I had the pleasure on Wednesday. look, I think the brand itself is quite slick. I also talked to Hans Holzbusch, who had said that the critics who'd kind of labelled it a bit bland have to realise that it's not just about the logo and it's about everything else. So I kind of agree with him there in that I haven't experienced, a Virgin Australia flight yet, nor check-in or any of those other details. So to comment widely on the brand is difficult, but certainly my first impressions are good. I think it's sleek, especially for the business market. My concern is that it could alienate the budget traveller, the low-cost traveller. They've had that competition with Jetstar for some time now, and Qantas' advantage is that they still have Jetstar. They still have their budget brand to target, and they've still got Qantas to target their business travellers. Virgin have now got Virgin to do both. Mm-hmm. So that's my only concern. They seem pretty excited about it, and Sir Richard, Mr. Branson, Richard, whatever I should call the knight, said, that because of being able to hopefully take over that Qantas business market, that they will still be able to facilitate low-cost fares for economy, but, the proof will be in the pudding.
Yes, yeah. No, I was slightly confused by the rebrand initially because I expected in the place of Virgin Blue another low-budget airline, but then there was Virgin Australia, then, and it's obviously they've gone up market. Tim, what do you think of the rebrand?
Yeah, I mean, it's worth, if you haven't done so, it's worth checking out the video interview that Alice has done as well. I thought one of the interesting points that Branson made was it was something I wish they'd done 10 years ago, because of course it has been confusing, the fact that there's been V Australia flying overseas, which probably didn't have great brand awareness. Virgin Blue, as you say, the sort of cheap and cheeky one. It kind of makes sense. And also, he made the point that that right now they're doing all of the things that John Borghetti probably feared when he worked at Qantas. Now that he's at Virgin, he knows what he was scared of. So that, it's the old Sun Tzu art of war thing, isn't it? Do the thing that your opponent would most wish you didn't do. It makes sense to me. Again, you'll see in the video Alice put to Hans Holzbusch the criticism on the Mumbrella comment thread that the logo was a little bland.
Yes, absolutely, and kind of he did defend that if it was a design competition. Anyone could have done it, really. It wasn't anything amazing, but it was just... It was the whole package that he was defending.
I think it's easy to be seduced by rebrand. I mean, rebrand, a brand is a long-term thing, right? It's supposed to last 50 years. Whereas there's easy to get to slip into the advertising mindset, a campaign mindset, that you should be bowled over and wowed by it. But campaigns have a beginning and an end, whereas a brand is indefinite. So Camille, having seen the rebrand and the ad campaign that's followed, are you more or less likely to fly with Virgin?
I fly with who's cheaper. I don't really care about a new logo.
But would you go as low as flying with Tiger?
I have gone as low as flying as
and
Tiger.
And did it fly
by low?
Well, you know, they have a terrible reputation for flying on time.
They were 15 minutes early. So I don't know if that's a rarity, because it was the first time.
Did it mean that anyone who arrived on time, it was too late and they'd gone? Or?
I beg your pardon?
So anybody who arrived on time?
No, they're obviously speeding in the air. I don't know. But they landed 15 minutes early. Okay. So,
well, that's because they lie about the journey times to try and... please, gullible consumers like yourself,
who
say, fly me, we were early. I know normally they're supposed to take half an hour longer than everyone else, but we were 15 minutes early.
Well, you should tell that to all the gullible travellers in the in the terminal with your little pamphlets. But I would just say that I'd like to see Virgin keeping its sense of fun, even though its whole aim is to maintain its to become a market leader, because the risk is it becoming another Qantas in terms of losing its brand differentiation, and that's the only thing for me.
And if I can just add, that was something that I did question Richard on, because I agree. I think it's something that really makes them stand out from the market. When it first came along and I first flew Virgin when they first came on the market in Australia, I was almost like, these people are going to look after me in the case of an emergency. Like, I was a bit concerned, but then I learned to appreciate that was part of their brand, and I put that to Richard, and he was, you know, pretty certain that wasn't going to leave the brand.
I tell you what I do hope they stop, though, is when I walk into the door, they look at, you know, the name I'm travelling under, which is the name of my passport. Hi, Timothy, welcome on board. Only one person calls me Timothy, and that's my mother.
Well, just quickly, what do you guys think of the ad that followed the rebrand, which was done by Clemenger BBDO
TV
Sydney?
Ad, you mean?
Yes.
I like the music. I like the dynamic sounding music with the electric guitars and the crew strutting with a sense of purpose towards the plane.
Yeah.
I was a bit disappointed. I was expecting some, you know, fist punches in the air and a bit of dancing.
I was expecting something to happen,
yeah,
but nothing did.
Yeah, the sense of, like, oh, no, we're getting on the plane now.
It had a letdown.
It felt like a few different things as well, didn't it? It felt a little bit like, do you remember the anniversary Virgin ad from the UK of them all striding through the airport? You know, sort of like it was a flashback to 1984, whatever the years, and they're playing Relax and everyone's, like, wearing, you know, and is looking bland for the BA crew, and then, you know, you get the sexy Virgin air crew kind of coming through, changing everything. That was all striding through airports, yeah, with pumping music.
Yeah.
Or the other one was, do you remember Tango with Ray Gardner marching through the office and then ending up on the white cliffs of Dover? There was a little element of that as well.
And that's not the first time in several months that we've mentioned Tango. That's,
absolutely,
that seems to be a common trend.
No, marching through the marching places is big in ads at the moment. In fact, you could probably mix together an excellent mishmash of marching ads.
So next, Matchmaker, Matchmaker, Make Me a Blog.
Now, a Melbourne blogger has launched a new service which presents itself as essentially a matchmaking service for brands and blogs. Brand Meets Blog will fill a gap in the market for companies that take a strategic approach to blogging and build what Brand Meets Blog describes as trust capital with bloggers. Now, Robin, this was a story that you wrote. Do you think, firstly, this is a real service? Is there a real gap in the market? Is it going to be big enough to sustain as a business, do you think?
Well, to be honest, when I wrote the story, I did do a search. I presumed there'd be a similar thing. I wasn't sure that there was a gap in the market. I imagine that it will be a good service if there's demand for it, because I'm not sure there's that much truth to what Louisa Claire was saying, that in general, brands are bad at engaging with bloggers. I know what you think, Camille, but yeah, she was saying that they mass message bloggers in the hope there'll be some uptake, rather than targeted campaigns against certain bloggers.
Do you know, I I still think there is a massive misunderstanding from brands and bloggers. I was in a circumstance where I was just earwigging on a conversation between a creative who was talking about a campaign where, as one element of their campaign, they'd sent a DM piece to a bunch of bloggers. And he was really cross and he couldn't understand why they hadn't then written about this DM piece. And it was just, he just didn't understand what they would look for in content at all.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'd like to find out a bit more about the model. How much does this cost? So do they effectively act as the middleman for the brand and exactly their PR agency?
Louisa Claire, she's making money. The way she's making money is the consultancy fee.
Yeah.
And also a newsletter.
Just these are the bloggers?
I guess on how brands should engage with bloggers. Obviously, they should get to know their content, should get to know them personally. And then think about ideas for weaving, I guess, the brand into an article that's written by a blogger.
I'd like to know, first of all, how much this does cost, because who's going to wear this cost? Will it be the PR agency? I don't think so, tight enough margins as it is. I know from our perspective, we have tailored key bloggers for individual clients, which we keep updated. Now, having said that, with the proliferation of the number of bloggers out there, a service such as this may potentially make it easier for you to keep in touch with everything, keep up to date with all who's writing about what. But having said that, could I just get Office Junior to keep track of that anyway? So it depends on the agency whether they've already got that in place.
So for you as a PR professional, when you approach or talk to a blogger, is it fundamentally different to how you would approach or talk to a journalist?
Not really, because if they're interested in the subject matter, I know that that's why I'm approaching them. So it's pretty much a similar kind of sell, whereas it's an opinion piece, however, in terms of how they approach the topic, but it's a topic of interest.
Do you ever get resistance? So bloggers are just, they want no engagement at all, and they almost feel offended from the fact that you're making contact.
No, not at all. I wouldn't say that at all. So I think it's just a case of, again, it's that targeted, relevant approach to in terms of the brand and the blog and the blogger. Well, and it's not actually that hard a science.
Right.
It's just a matter of investing the time to do it. So whether you want to do it internally or whether you want to, if it's more cost effective, to actually pay for an external service, that's something you have to decide on your own.
Yeah, but it seems, the early signs are it's doing pretty well. I mean, Louisa Claire said that her biggest client at the moment, well, one of her clients is Porta Novelli, which is a fairly big PR agency which clearly needs some help in that regard. And she said she's got 12 other small and large businesses working with her. And the comments in the comment stream, was it sort of whiff of AstroTurf? I'm not sure. But
yes,
it seems to be quite positive.
Suspiciously positive, wasn't it?
Yes.
Sort of from the extent you think, hang on.
Yes.
Particularly, for me, one of the signs that maybe we're being AstroTurfed is when there are loads of positive comments before we've even posted the story onto the email where we get a lot of our traffic from. And you think, well, where's that all coming from? I'm not quite sure. Next, MasterChef and Australia's Got Talent go head to head.
So following the ratings season pause, we see MasterChef return to our screens on 10 and Australia's Got Talent on 7. Sadly for 9, their exciting new reality show AFP, or Australian Federal Police, saw the second episode only drawing 856,000 viewers. The first episode of MasterChef on Sunday night pulled 1.56 million, while the Logies got 1.32 million. So, Camille, have you been watching?
None of it. But it's pretty sad. 2 years in the making, the Andrew Denton show, AFP. And what are they? What, 1.2 million?
The first one was 1.2 million, then faded right down to 856,000 for the second outing. I mean, in defence of AFP, I think probably it's on the wrong night. Feels to me like a Sunday show.
You should have a word with Channel 9's programming guy and give him some advice, Tim.
Well,
I'm sure they'd appreciate
that. If I was Channel 9's programming guy, his problem is they have nothing for Tuesdays. They've got nothing in the locker. Everything that's been there has been slaughtered. Mike and Molly has just died.
Two and a half men's God,
bust.
They were riding on that for a while,
weren't
they?
Big Bang Theory is kind of on the critical list, I guess. So, what do you put up against, that sort of tough programming of Australia's Got Talent and MasterChef?
Mm.
So unfortunately for AFP, that's been the cannon fodder that's been sent out there, which is a shame because it's a well-made show.
So MasterChef, early thoughts on the first few episodes?
Yeah, so that, you know, it only just debuted at number one. You know, it was close to Australia's Got Talent. It would have been disastrous for them if it had been number two, mainly because they launched it against the Logies.
But isn't it the sort of show that MasterChef is, isn't it the sort of show that takes time to warm up? I mean, I watched a bit of the flick between the Logies and MasterChef, and I can't say that it wasn't particularly dramatic. I mean, it's all about setting the scene, but it's a drama that takes time to build.
Right? It is about building it up, and, you know, particularly in those first few days when you've got 50 contestants, you're not going to care about them. So the first, and you know, we've seen it running very, very close. It's been winning every night, though. So
it's been quite strong ratings, though. 1.6 million is nothing to scoff
at.
Yeah,
no, that's great. That's great. I mean, even on Wednesday night, it again came in just number one, just ahead of Australia's Got Talent. So MasterChef for Wednesday delivered 1.5 to Australia's Got Talent's 1.45. So, you know, just ahead, but ahead, which is the important thing. And then, you know, again, just a nightmare for Nine, where their best performer in that evening area was a David Attenborough documentary on Madagascar, 848,000. So, wow. You know, Nine is up against it at the moment, certainly in reaching all people. Yeah. So I don't think we've seen the end of that story quite yet.
And the Logies, what do you think of that? Did you guys watch Karl Stefanovic praise his
wife? You're shaking your head. What were you doing on Sunday? How did you escape all of this stuff?
Obviously, I had something better to do than watch television.
I'm sorry. I was flicking back and forth between the Logies and MasterChef. I did both. So, yes, it was nice to see the first robot win a gold Logie. So, yeah.
The what?
The first robot winner.
The first robot.
Robot to win a gold Logie. Yeah, Karl Stefanovic's Wikipedia entry read...
Can you actually pronounce the surname correctly?
Do you prefer Stefanovic? I don't like that pronunciation.
Okay, all right, we'll change his name
then. I reject that pronunciation. But no, his Wikipedia entry described him as the first human cyborg to have a television slot. Initially, and now to win a Logie.
I like that he added a bit of colour to it, though, in terms of bringing it down, with his comment about his wife having the best ass.
The best ass. Seen. I think, in his defence, and it was put as an off-colour comment, I think it probably he'd been covering the royal wedding. He'd obviously flown straight back from that, and it was all about those Facebook groups. The Pippa Middleton's Ass Appreciation Society was the Facebook group that went viral. So. My suspicion is it was a little nod towards that, which kind
you
of...
You think he was being clever?
Well, I think he was...
Oh, wow.
Well, or arguably, being a TV presenter, perhaps it was just the fact that was what was top of mind, because that was what he'd last been talking about. But yeah, so I suspect that was perhaps the context of it that was lost on the night.
Well, I actually didn't mind the comment. I mean, if I was someone's wife and they told the national audience that I had the best ass ever, I'd be like, yep, thank you. But also... I didn't realize the Logies were so highbrow. I mean, sorry, how did he bring that level down? Anyway.
Next, Cummins versus Anonymous.
To advertise with one of the top 10 most loved brands in Australia, visit advertise.ebay.com.au.
So we've been busy putting together the programme for Mumbrella 360, and this week we've finally published something close to a final version. Still a few little gaps here and there, but 47 sessions, and we're mostly nailed down now. So obviously I can't tell you the contents of all 47 sessions now, otherwise we'd be going on for a long time. So we've announced Tourism Australia Managing Director Andrew McAvoy will be joining us to discuss the Oprah Winfrey coup, how she ended up coming over to Australia and give some great publicity as a destination. Also, Sean Cummins of Cummins Ross will, I guess he'll take a stand against anonymous blog commenters, which is probably a good topic to talk about now as well. Robin, I mean, they're kind of, you know, they're meat and drink from Umbrella, the anonymous commenters, but how do you feel about it as a concept?
I think I like it. To be honest, I think that having come from Singapore, I'm a big sort of proponent of free speech. And I think being able to comment anonymously allows a lot of people who would think otherwise that they get into trouble with their employers or perhaps their clients to talk freely. And I think that's really important. And I think also that people do moan about sometimes being overly critical or negative. But I think that actually there's a sort of Darwinian sort of element to commenting, that if someone does lay it on a bit too thick, then someone else will correct them. And there's a cycle of, yeah, someone says something and someone counterbalances it. And so yeah, no, I'm all for it.
Camille, you obviously in your days on Mumbrella spent plenty of time moderating that comment stream. Your view?
Nothing wrong with anonymous comments if they're actually adding value to the conversation. These, you know, one-worded, you know, swear words, you know, shit, et cetera, really don't help the conversation. So if they're adding value to it, absolutely, and they've got an intelligent point of view to make, then not too worried about it.
Now, Launch Group is curating a session itself for Mumbrella 360. Yeah. It's probably worth just mentioning that.
Yeah, who is Gen Z and why should we care, basically? So these are the teens of today who will be entering the workforce. And they're actually quite different to Gen Y. You know, Gen Y was the me generation, and Gen Z is more the we generation. So they're actually quite different characteristics and behaviors, more of a social conscience, for example, back to family. So we've got to think about how brands would need to engage with this type of consumer and you know, how it would affect the work-life balance, for example.
And will there be any real-life Gen Zs on the panel?
Yeah, we'll bring them out in a box, and the audience gets to pick which one they can play with for the session, for that hour. We've got to bring it back, though. We can't. It's not a freebie.
So I'm interested about the observation of Gen Z being different to Gen Y. So what's that based on research?
We'll be revealing some research on the day, so you should come along to the session.
Well, the programme in full can be found at a different website to Mumbrella. It's mumbrella360.com.au, so do check it out. That's all we have time for today. Thanks again to Launch Management Group's Camille Alacon.
Thank you, Tim.
To Mumbrella's Robin Hicks.
Cheers, Tim.
And to CBS Interactive for the studio. Production was by Alice Terlikowski. I'm Tim Burrows. See you next week. Toodle-pip.